Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Screen Talk Radio. We hope your Valentine's Day was as memorable as that clip from When Harry Met Sally. In our honor of Valentine's Day this past Friday, Devin and I thought we'd start off with one of our favorite scenes from a comedy movie that we both know is near and dear to our hearts. Devin, did you have a special Valentine's Day, or was it nothing special for you?
It was pretty quiet. I just spent some of the time in the office here writing and then just relaxing the rest of the day.
You didn't go on a date or anything?
No, I'm a dateless wonder.
Devin, ladies, Devin's single. All three of you listening, Devin's a single guy. He's not only very charismatic and very eloquent, but he's also, wealthy and independent and has cats and not dogs and doesn't leave a mess. So he's perfect. But in all seriousness, Devin, in honor of Valentine's Day, and actually Script Girl's got up, her piece is also in honor of Valentine's Day when we get to her in a minute. Sex scenes in movies, I love them. I think they're necessary. They got to be in there. I don't care if it's, an action film or something. We got to have our sex scenes, right?
I don't think they're absolutely necessary.
What?
I really don't believe that they're entirely necessary.
Studio executives are moaning across Hollywood as you speak. You got to have a sex scene.
Well, if you're Paul Verhoeven, then yeah. I mean, it's kind of necessary. But yeah, as we all know, Showgirls, okay, what happened
Ooh,
with that?
One of my favorites in my top five, Showgirls.
It's one of my top five drinking game movies to watch. But
why?
Well, in all seriousness, though, you can have a movie that just implies sex. It's actually more fun sometimes to have a sex scene that isn't really, it's just implied, where you see the aftermath of something. You can get an idea of, wow, that was wild. Like if you see somebody handcuffed to the bed with
I'm looking for my whips and chains then,
Yeah, with a goat walking by, it's like your mind fills in the blanks, and it's probably even more hilarious just watching that. But watching choreographed sex scenes gets a little old after a while. If it's necessary for the story,
that's a good point. They should make those sex scenes not be choreographed. They should just throw the actors in there nude and say go at it and put the cameras in there and just see what happens.
Well, there actually is a movie out there where they did do that, where the actors did engage in sexual intercourse on camera, and I've always asked myself, why isn't that classified as pornography? But it's not.
What movie is that? Let me get a pencil here. What movie is that? You don't know?
It's 13 Songs. Is the name of the movie?
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
So you don't think we could deal? We could get really crazy and talk about how a writer should write a sex scene. But we won't do that. Anyways, moving on. Welcome to Screen Talk Radio. This is the only weekly hour-long show dedicated to you, the screenwriter. Last week, we had Christopher Lockhart on from William Morris, and we didn't get a chance to announce it live, unless you happen to hear the playback, that he selected Joe Griffin's Bullet Has a Soul pitch as our winner of Screen Talk's first Radio Pitch Fest. And Devin, I think we both are of the agreement that we've got to do more of these.
Yes, definitely. It was much to our surprise, it was extremely popular, and we definitely want to do it again. We want to definitely expand the format and make it longer so we can take
right.
more pitches instead of trying to cram more into an hour.
And Chris has agreed to come back probably in March. We're also looking at lining up some other executives, and I think our goal is to make a script pitch fest at least a once a month, hopefully once a month deal, because we had over 11,000 listeners, over 60 callers. We took 20 pitches, which wasn't enough. We needed to take more. We started off taking, I think, too much time. And you know, just to give those of you who listened last week, we said in the intro to that show that we reserved a right to cut you off at any time. We guaranteed you nothing, but you had a minute total in case everything worked out. So some people called in, and I think we kind of took a little too much time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think we did go a little long. We did end up going a little long in certain ones, but that's, again, why we want to expand the format for that particular show to something like 90 minutes and
right.
really give everybody more breathing room.
Maybe we can even do a two-hour show and have several executives on. By the way, those of you who are listening, if you want to log into ScreenwritersUtopia.com, Christopher Lockhart has an article up there written about the art or the construction of a pitch. It's a must-read at ScreenwritersUtopia.com. We just put that up there today. It's courtesy of Christopher Lockhart, originally published in Screenwriters Monthly magazine that I was a part of years ago. And that is a must-read. It'll help those of you who might be pitching in the future. Of course, if you're going to call in next time Chris is here, it'll help you out certainly in being more prepared if you didn't feel that you did your best job. Though I was impressed overall. There were a few that were kind of sketchy, a couple that were kind of funny. You know, the poet and then the one-legged boxer. Though of course I thought he did a good job pitching it. But overall, the quality was pretty solid. Devin, were you surprised at all by that?
I was actually very surprised. Out of the 19 callers we had, he accepted or considered five of them, which is about 26%. That's a much higher acceptance rate than I thought he would actually have. I thought it was going to be a lot more brutal than it really was.
You think Chris was being generous, or do you think?
No, I think he was being honest with everybody that called in, and that's really that's a good mark of someone at that level. Who has to say no, you know, 100 times a day,
right,
to various people and tell them why.
Right.
And as writers, we have to have a really thick skin to take that kind of criticism and not take it personally.
And that's a good point. And we want to thank Christopher Lockhart again for being a part of the show. And we look forward to him coming back and taking pitches. He said he's open to it. We don't have anything firm set in stone yet. And Chris certainly reserves the right to not come back, and we're pretty confident he will be back. And I don't want to get into too much news right now because we've got a bunch of things we have to get to. We've got two great interviews, and we've got Script Girl. But sad news today out of Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. If you weren't aware, Mickey Rourke's Chihuahua Loki, 18, died Monday. It's very very sad news. Mickey Rourke's dog, Loki. Devin, 18 years. What's that in dog years?
126.
Wow. You're a math. So we want to take a moment of silence for Mickey Rourke's Chihuahua Loki. why is that news? Why is this news?
Yeah,
why is Mickey...
Well, it's something he attributed his dogs to.
I know, to his success. The state of California is about to implode economically. Our economy is in shambles, and somehow people think that we want to know about Mickey Rourke's Chihuahua. I love the man. He's absolutely crazy. That's kind of appealing to me for any human being. But I don't know. I don't know why we need to know that his dog died of 18 years on Monday. Now, if it was his spouse, that'd be something. But, you know, I just don't get it. I don't get it at all.
The power of Christ compels you.
That's not very funny, Devin.
I'm sorry, I had to do that.
That's not funny though. I don't a lot. You can count. I will not do that. I won't again the rest of the show. That's not very funny. I'm the one who picks on you. You don't pick on me. That's not very funny.
You can't you can dish it out, but you can't take it, huh?
No, I can't. Come on. All right. Sponsors for this show. Final Draft. Use what the professionals use. That's Final Draft. You can check them out at finaldraft.com or go to screenwritersutopia.com and register as a user and get excellent discounts for Final Draft products. We recommend you do that. Also, Blue Cat Screenwriting Competition, bluecatscreenplay.com. Submit your screenplay now. Time is running down. I believe there's 12 days left. And you'll find out that Gordy Hoffman, our interview number two subject tonight, one of his latest projects, he's over in England getting set up, it was found via the Blue Cat website and their competition. So check them out. They've been longtime supporters of SU, and we encourage you to check them out. Also, we're willing to take some callers this hour in between the interview and also the interview with Mr. Hoffman, and, of course, we have Paul Haggis coming up here in a second. But we want to get here shortly to Script Girl. She's in Hollywood, and she's got the latest script sales from last week. Here she is.
Hello, young lovers. This is Script Girl in Hollywood with your weekly script sales report for Friday, February 13th, 2009. First up, Universal won a bidding war for The Adventurer's Handbook based on the book by Mick Confrey. The comedy by Jonah Hill, Matt Spicer, and Max Winkler tells of a quartet of pals who embark on an unbelievable global adventure. Jonah Hill and Jason Schwartzman will star. Hill, Spicer, and Winkler will also produce. They are repped by the United Talent Agency. Christopher Nolan sold his spec Inception to Warner Brothers. He will also direct the sci-fi actioner reportedly set within the architecture of the human mind. Unfortunately, this development means Nolan's sequel to The Dark Knight will undoubtedly be delayed. Nolan and Emma Thomas will produce. He is repped by CAA's Dan Aloney. Jeff Lowell sold his spec based on Spencer Quinn's novel Doggone It to Universal Pictures for a high six figures. The comedy's about a down-on-his-luck private eye and his loyal dog who investigate a missing persons case. The story will be told from the K-9 Police School Rejects point of view. Daniel Rapoport, Ben Forkner, and Kathy Schulman will produce. Lowell is repped by UTA's David Kramer. Jonathan Herman also got six figures for his first-time feature spec, Conviction, which sold to Warner Brothers. The thriller centers around an FBI agent who forces an ex-con/master thief to help entrap his protege in the midst of a multi-million dollar heist. Herman started out as a producer's assistant, but quit his development exec job at Canal Plus 3 years ago to focus full-time on screenwriting. You did it, Jonathan, but don't forget where you came from. Andrew Rona and Joel Silver will produce. And finally, the Writers Guild Awards were held last weekend. Congratulations to Simon Beaufoy for his best original screenplay, Slumdog Millionaire, and to Dustin Lance Black for his best adapted screenplay, Milk. That's all for now. Happy Valentine's Day, and remember, you can't sell it if you don't write it.
All right, thank you to Script Girl live. Well, not live. I wish she was live. When she recorded that, it was live. But coming from Los Angeles, Hollywood, we appreciate her allowing us to play her script sales. Devin, one thing that you and I both talked about for the aspiring writer trying to break in is the competition level. Fewer and fewer writers, professional writers, are writing more and more or being hired to write more and more of the movies in Hollywood. It's the economy isn't going to help that, certainly any. What advice could we give, you know, the aspiring writer in terms of breaking in to a situation that already was tough enough as it is? They're competing. You look at the spec script sales. They haven't been well in a long time. But you're competing against professional writers.
Well, I'd say the main thing is persistence, not giving up. If you truly believe you have a good story, don't give up. Write as many as you can, too. Keep writing. That is very important. Hone your craft. The other thing you might want to consider is think about actually producing it yourself. Try and take on the mantle of filmmaker also. Get a good idea of what the whole process is like.
And you know what? And with that's a good idea. And also with, you know, the bailout money and the stimulus package, maybe there's money available there writers can borrow. I don't know if there's money allocated to Hollywood, that there was some talk of that. But writers, you know, you can certainly consider writing a script that's conscious of your budget, Devin. Isn't there's a way for writers to be very conscious of, okay, how many speaking parts do I have? You know, what's my action? Am I going to try to avoid costly sets, avoid filming at night? Aren't there things they can do to avoid a high-budget script that they can take to an independent producer and for maybe a couple $1 million make a decent film?
Yes, there actually is. One of the top things you can do is keep it contemporary, set it in present time, hopefully in a place not unlike an area you know. Therefore, you can find locations, especially in the small towns across America, use locations that you know
right. That
will be very easily acquired to use. That really helps a lot. When you have to build up something like that, a whole production, it really helps having that foundation there. Number of speaking parts, if you have to go SAG signatory, that's really good. You can get SAG actors for your projects. You may end up paying a premium for those actors, where you might find some hidden talent that is not SAG right around where you live. So that's another place.
Moving on. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's another place.
And that's good advice.
Yeah.
That's good advice. And Devin, as you already know, Devin's got his first film coming out in this summer, and a lot of that you participate hands-on. Look, getting to our writing debate of the week, kind of looking at last week's pitches that we saw, and there are some key elements or some key ideas that Christopher Lockhart really pointed to that some writers had some mistakes in how they pitched. And for you, Devin, you had a good pickup on what was probably a couple of the main problems in the architecture or the construction of a pitch. Can you kind of hit on a couple of those that you think we writers could look towards improving their pitches in the future?
Well, I think one of them that stood out for me the most was people pitching not from the protagonist's point of view, but rather just characters that are basically in the periphery of the story, talking about what they do, but not what the protagonist does. The protagonist drives your story. So you want to have your pitch centered around that and what the protagonist does in the narrative. That's your main thrust you want to get out. And get it out as soon as you can. If you can distill everything down to a single log line first and then lead in with that, that's going to help you out a lot.
And also, you touched upon it, but concept-wise, some writers think they have a story when really all they have is an idea for a story.
Right. the main thing, the problem is concept versus actual story. A concept is maybe just a fraction or a shard of a scene, or maybe a couple of scenes that might not even be connected, where with a story you have a full narrative that goes from beginning to middle to end, and that's a complete one. There's a great distinction between the two. If you can come up with a complete story based on a concept, great. Go ahead and make that whole thing out, but make sure you have that done before you actually pitch, because you're not going to have anything really to talk about. There's nothing happening. It's just a concept. In a story, something happens.
Right. And this goes into also with, I think, a lot of writers, not a lot, but a lot who I read is, especially, this is reminiscent, especially with their character development. Oftentimes, writers today think that attitude is character. And it's the same idea with a story idea versus a story. They're different animals, and you're not fully developing your story. You're not creating really a truly sellable story if you don't have well-drawn characters, a highly crafted story, and if you can't convey in a short pitch or a log line or a synopsis, if you can't convey in that brief moment that you're a good writer, that story executive, that story reader is not going to believe you can write 115, 110 pages that's worth of crap. I mean, if you can't create in a micro level, they're not going to believe you can do it on a macro level. Would you agree, Devin?
Oh, absolutely. If you can't, let's say you've already written the story, and then you try to go back and write the log line, and you can't write the log line, there's probably a good chance you don't really have a story. You just have a jumbling of scenes together that have no coherency to them as a narrative. So
right.
you really got to focus on that and make sure.
All right,
you can.
No, go ahead, finish. Make sure you can what?
Well, make sure that you can, in fact, distill the essence of your story down to a log line, a single sentence.
Right. It's part of the art of being a writer. A writer just doesn't make a script and then hand it away. They have to be able to tell you about it. They have to be able to explain it in a way that it's going to make someone want to read it. All right, we're going to move on to our interview. We have two tonight. The first one is with Paul Haggis. He's a Oscar-nominated writer for 2004 Million Dollar Baby, directed by Clint Eastwood. He was interviewed recently by The Dialogue, Learning from the Masters. It's a series of interviews with professional writers. You can get this full interview online at Amazon.com. It's an exceptional interview. What we have here is about a 10, 12-minute clip from that, and I think it's a great kind of tidbit or insight into the interview that you can purchase on Amazon. And the folks over there at The Dialogue were kind enough to allow us to play this for you tonight so you could get an idea of the quality of the interviews that they have. So without further ado, here's the interview with Paul Haggis.
I'm Mike DeLuca. Welcome to this rare In the Trenches look at the craft of screenwriting. Today I'm sitting with Paul Haggis, writer, director, producer, whose screenplay for Million Dollar Baby was nominated for an Oscar. Paul's also the co-writer and director and producer of the indie breakout hit Crash. Thank you, Paul, for being with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Is it true you used to move furniture for a living?
That's how I started, yes. When I moved down here, my dad actually was the one who recommended I come to Hollywood. I was working construction with him in the summertime and working in theater in the wintertime, and he was actually producing some of the plays. And you know, I think I wrote two of the worst pieces of theater ever to be produced in Canada. And I was driving down the road with him one day and going to a job, and he said, construction, you're no damn good at it, are you? And I said, no, I'm really not. He said, why don't you go to Hollywood?
Had you thought about taking screenwriting seriously before your dad suggested it?
I think I was in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
I turned in a composition, and my teacher said, you're good at that. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be a writer from that on.
That put the bug.
Yeah, and I wrote plays and bad screenplays and bad everything, but really loved it.
When did you first feel like you had what it took to be a screenwriter?
When I was about 40, I think,
mm-hmm.
after earning a very good living as a very bad writer for many years.
Oh, hardly.
Oh, no, really.
Right.
I earned a very good living as a bad writer.
What were some of the shows that you
Different
worked?
Strokes.
Different Strokes.
Facts of Life, One Day at a Time, worked my way up in television. I tried I'd written some screenplays on spec and tried to sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, I think what we call in the business, quite bad. And so it's a technical term we use as writers.
Right. How many screenplays do you think you'd written before your first produced credit?
I think I'd written four or five.
Do you think it's a necessary evil that you have to write a certain amount of bad screenplays to get to a place where you're writing nothing but good screenplays?
Oh, yeah, because you have to write in order to write.
Right.
You don't have to get any good at it. You just have to write and write and write.
How important is discipline to your work habits?
I know I have to write every day. Not every day, 5 days a week, or as much as I can. When I start to write, I give myself a goal of 5 pages a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't stop until I get that done, whether it's taking me 2 hours or 12. Sometimes if I get rolling, then I can write more.
Right.
I can write 10 pages.
But that's your minimum.
Yes, my minimum is 5 pages.
And you find that kind of routine helps you get through.
Yeah. Every scene you come to, you
right.
know that the last scene was easy to write, but this scene is impossible.
Right.
And you get through that, and you see the next one, you go, well, that one was easy to write, but this one's impossible.
Right.
Every single scene is usually like that.
Right. The new one is the impossible one.
Always impossible. And then the characters start talking to you.
In your life, in your process, where do you find the most inspiration? Like, what really inspires you to sit down and start thinking of stories? And...
You know, it's odd places. A notion will get in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking of something for the last year that I want to write about. And I just, whenever I get around someone who knows something about that, I'll just pick their brain
right.
and talk. And so I'm interested in so many things, but as long as, and so many genres as well, as long as at the center there's some great human dilemma,
mm-hmm.
some question I do not have the answer for,
right.
And something that scares me.
Right.
If I'm really comfortable with a project, I just don't want to do it. It's of no interest to me.
Right.
It's only if I can... If only I'm pretty sure that I can actually fail at this,
right.
do I want to attempt it?
Is there a point when you're writing a spec screenplay where you've hit the point of no return mark, where you know it's going to be good and it's worth completing? And have you ever bailed on one where you thought?
Bail on them all the time.
Right.
Yeah. You, especially in the story stage.
Do you feel an education in screenwriting from a formal institution is necessary to succeed in the business?
Well, it didn't, you know. I didn't need one, and
right.
it just took me a lot longer.
There was no substitute for actual working experience.
No, it wasn't until 30-something, I think, that I actually figured out how to write, and figured out what I should be doing as a writer, not how to write. And I turned in my first script, and they just finished doing the pilot, and they said, really, really interesting script, Paul. What's it about? And I said, well, it's about this clever plot turn, it's
right.
about this piece of dialogue and this funny thing here. And they, yeah, we see that. But what does it mean to you? Where does it come from within you? And I said, it's supposed to do that? And it just shook me up, and I went back and I rewrote. And from that point to now, I've sort of tried very, very, it took a long, long time
mm-hmm.
To sink into this, what passes for my psyche.
How big a factor does commerciality play into your line of thought, or
None.
If at all? None.
When I decided to leave television, I...
Did you leave without a net? Like, did you have the feature set up
well,
already?
No, I had nothing. No, I went home, and we just finished building a new house. And television, they pay you just a shitload of money.
Right.
And we're very grateful to take it. And I'd finished this television show, and it just it wasn't making me happy, what I was doing. It was sort of feeding my soul. And so I went home and talked to my wife, and she'd been bugging me to write this movie, Crash, for a while. I'd come up with the idea a year before.
What's the genesis of the idea?
It was many jumping off points, but one, I was carjacked in 1991,
mm-hmm.
and these writers, we don't react like human beings react. You know, rather than rage or anger, I became curious about who these two kids were who stuck guns in my face. I never intended to write about them, but 10 years later, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I just, damn, and I hate getting ideas in the middle of the night. So this time I woke up and wrote it down, and then started asking myself who they bumped into, because I've always been curious about the interaction of strangers
mm-hmm.
and how we affect each other. And so I asked myself who they bumped into, and that was easy. That was myself and my wife. So I fictionalized us and took us home.
Right.
Asked myself what I did, and I said, well, we changed the locks at 2:00 in the morning. And then I like asking myself difficult questions. I don't think writers should write about answers. I think we should write about questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I asked myself was, what if that person had come to change the locks at 2:00? What if he'd been Hispanic, young, buzzed hair,
mm-hmm.
what looked in my ignorance to be gang tattoos, baggy pants? Would I have felt safe?
Hmm.
And I said, no, I don't think I would have. Ooh, that's really dark territory. I have to
right.
write about this. So I brought him in, and then he had one line in my outline, and I said, well, he just heard these horrible things that Sandra Bullock's character would say. I wonder what happens to him. So I followed him, and I just kept following the characters.
Right.
So I woke up, 10:00 in the morning, I had this entire sort of 30-page outline done.
Well, what's great about the film, too, is it manages to find its way back to what we can all relate to about what we want in our own lives. You know, whether it's Matt Dillon dealing with his father, you know, we've all felt put upon at a certain point by responsibilities or things that we wish we weren't.
Yeah, Matt's character came from a piece of hate mail I received. It was an interracial couple that week on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And someone wrote in to say, why is it in television that it's always the white people who are the villains and the black people who are the victims? Let me tell you a story about my father. And he went on in this letter to tell me the story that Matt Dillon tells about his father.
When you approach the writing of a scene like that, or any scene, do you come at it from what's the plot of this scene or what's the themes I'm dealing with?
I never wanted to make a statement about race.
Right.
We were just following these characters around and they started talking about this. Usually the characters are where I start and then just continue asking myself what's the worst thing that can happen to this character.
How did you approach writing about experiences or cultures that you had no firsthand knowledge of?
Well, it's actually quite simple. Right. If you know the given circumstances of a person's life, but you have to know the specific given circumstances, then you just put yourself in that person's place and don't judge them. What I love writing about is the contradictions that we all embody as, mm-hmm. as human beings. I realized if right after 30-something, sometime after that, I realized if I was this screwed up, maybe other people were too.
Right.
If I could embody these contradictions, maybe others could, and so I started writing about them.
Did you ever have a broken heart? Did you ever go through periods where you were totally dispirited and thought, well, this isn't working out for me?
Failure and success, I mean, it doesn't really matter as long as you keep doing what you love to do.
Right.
And that will carry you through. And
right.
If you die having not succeeded at what you want to do, but having followed your dream, I think you're a success. From the very beginning, I knew that if something didn't sell, it was my fault. It wasn't anyone else's.
Right.
And so I never blamed my agent, never blamed my manager, things like this. I didn't beat myself up for it.
Right.
I didn't say, my God, you'll never be able to write. Because you can't write right now.
Right.
So maybe next week you'll be able to write, and maybe you'll get better.
Is there one piece of wisdom, you know, that you feel, as far as screenwriting goes, that cannot be repeated enough?
Always write from your gut.
Right.
No matter what the thing is, no matter what the project is, always believe that question you're asking yourself is worth answering or worth trying to answer, and then just continue to explore that.
Okay, if you want to listen to the rest of the interview with Paul Haggis, you can go to thedialogueseries.com. There's a series of interviews there with various professional writers. I think a couple of things that you can really pick up from when you listen to these professional, experienced, award-winning writers is things like Paul talked about, Mr. Haggis talked about there. Write what you know, write from your gut. Write what is passionate to you. Don't worry about concept. Don't worry about high concept. Too many times, like Devin and I talked about with the pitches and the writers who think they have a story when really they have just a concept. Your story is about passion. And like Paul said there in that excellent clip was writers aren't supposed to, the writers shouldn't try to answer questions. It's ask questions. We're not looking for answers as writers. We're looking to explore questions. And I think that's really part of the process of being a writer should be a discovery. So, and Paul's comments in that interview are some really incredible in-depth insights into the writing process. Devin, do you have anything from that kind of struck you as interesting, profound, or something?
Well, the writing what you know part, that is definitely something every writer should do from the get-go. Write what you know. I only write what I know. And it seems to pay off for me, so.
Well, I think it's kind of funny how writers scan the script sales pages as if somehow they're going to pick up on an idea that's going to help them write a story. I mean, first of all, that by the time a writer, somebody sitting at home in front of the computer, sees a trend, they've already missed it. So you should write, like you said, write from your gut, write what you know. And your first movie is from a genre that you know well and is passionate for you.
Yep. Not only that, the characters themselves are developed from people, just people I've been, they're conglomerations or aggregates of different people that just had very interesting characteristics to themselves and personalities that I really loved. So I put them all together in there. And it seemed to work really well, watching them all, basically putting them into a giant test tube and shaking it up and seeing what happens. It's a lot of fun.
All right, we're going to take a 30-second break. You're listening to Screen Talk Radio.
Shout out to every young brother, you know, just doing his bid right now. Keep your head up. walk in the yard, wish you had wings to just, you know, fly up out of that joint. Man.
All right, welcome back to Screen Talk Radio. Our next interview is with Gordy Hoffman. He is an award-winning screenwriter and director whose credits include La Lisa, winner of the Waldo Salt Award at the 2002 Sundance Film Festival. He's also written A Coat of Snow, which was an award winner, and he's currently in the UK producing and preparing to direct a script that he found through the Blue Cat Workshop. So up next is our recorded interview. We spoke with Gordy on, I guess it was yesterday we spoke with him. He couldn't make it live. Once again, he's in the UK. The time difference didn't allow him to join us live, but here's that interview. Thanks. So we'll get into the questions. We won't take up too much of your time, and we appreciate you joining us.
Gordy,
Let's go ahead and get going. Anyways, my first question is, in 2002, you were the winner of the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award at Sundance for Love, Lisa. Were you involved in the Writers' Lab as well? And can you tell us a little bit about that experience in terms of that film festival and your award there?
I was not in the feature lab. Love, Liza was a finalist for the lab in 97, long time ago, long before it was, well, a couple years, three or four years before it was produced. But it wasn't accepted in, but it was definitely, I mean, we interviewed with Michelle Satter, the film was obviously made and accepted to Sundance. It was actually the festival, it happened the year, that was only a few months after 9/11, so it was actually kind of slow there that year, and submissions were down, and it was kind of an off year in terms of attendance, but I just remember it, everyone's kind of speaking to that and it being kind of a old school Sundance, but it was great. It was like a dream experience. And, you know, if you go up there, I think it's the kind of experience that anybody would want to have. I mean, we sold our film to Sony Classics on Tuesday after a couple screenings and, went on to win an award. And so it was really a very special time for everybody. It was involved in the movie.
Can you give a little background on the screenplay? You were the sole writer accredited. Was that a story you came up with, or can you give us a little bit about the process in terms of that screenplay?
I came up with the idea. I randomly come up with different ideas pretty frequently, and it was just an idea about a man, kind of a normal man, who starts huffing gasoline. And now it's kind of the seed of the idea, and then once I started to develop, the story a little bit, I thought, well, what would kind of propel him into that? And I kind of came up with a catastrophic event, and then I went from there, and the story kind of developed on its own. It's a pretty... one story, it's one guy, it's a pretty simple story, very linear, so that's where it came up with, and I wrote the first draft in about 3 weeks, and then from there we kind of, continued to work on it.
How did that screenplay help you with your career? Did it open some doors for you, I assume? I know that you're the older brother to Philip Seymour Hoffman, but how did that screenplay help you in terms of your career and getting you more jobs and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, I went back to L.A. and, a little while after that, I got signed at William Morris. I was already with a management company, pretty big management company there, and so I went on a number of meetings. I ended up getting a job out of it that took me to Europe for a little bit, but I think what it did was it kind of got me into this studio, into the agency world and in Hollywood. And once I did that, I wrote another spec, which was a comedy, which was very unlike the tone of Love Liza, and that actually got me a lot of meetings and got a lot of relationships that I have to this day, you know. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, there's something that happens at Sundance which is almost, surrealistic. I mean, and there's people that go up to Sundance and have completely what they would characterize as kind of bad experiences, you know, bad reviews, their movie doesn't sell. And they come back, and maybe a couple months later it sells, and then it goes on and does really well. I mean, a movie that, I think the movie that Your Secretary, which ended up going on to be a very pretty successful movie, and the guy who directed Secretary has made a number of movies since then. He's a really great director. And he had a really bad Sundance. Like, I think the movie might have won a small award, but it wasn't bought at Sundance, and it really didn't do very well there, and he had a kind of a weird experience. And there's a couple of people, Justin Lin had a film up there at that time. So it doesn't necessarily translate. Sometimes it does directly, and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it has an inverse effect. But it's pretty sustaining. I mean, it's a very prestigious award, the writing award there, and it's the most influential. It's quite possibly the most influential film festival in the world, and so it definitely, no matter what, it's a remarkable thing that happened with the movie.
Right now you're in the UK preparing to direct a script that you found through the Blue Cat workshops. You're involved with the Blue Cat screenwriting competition. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now with that and what's going
on
with
that? We had a woman submitted to Blue Cat maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and she contacted me about her screenplay at one point. We reconvened, we hadn't talked for a little while, and she came to the Chicago workshop that we had. We had a couple of workshops in Chicago, and last March, actually, she came. I remembered her writing. It was really very, very strong, and I just, told her. I mean, she's really one of the only obviously a writer myself, and she's one of the only writers that I've ever read that I felt really drawn to directing their work. And so I just emailed her after the workshop and said, hey, I kind of mentioned it to her. And so she pitched me a couple ideas, and I liked one of them. And I told her, I said, it's great, why don't you send me that? And so in August she sent it to me, and I was about ready to go over to London. The script is set in Europe, and I came over to London to teach a workshop for Blue Cat, and kind of, long story short, ended up at an agency over here, and it just quickly developed. It got in front of a producer, and we just kind of made it our intention, Heather and I, to follow through and direct, make this movie. So we're producing and directing. I'm directing, and Blue Cat's involved in producing the movie. And so I'm over here right now just starting to get, try and get some talent attached to the project and move forward. I'm being kind of elusive about what it's about right now, but it's just now we don't really want to talk about the story yet, but it's very, very exciting. It's a really, really tremendous thing. I mean, I moved over to London, so I'm kind of going to be over here for most of the year, and I think we're going to shoot it in August, September is when we're probably when we're going to end up shooting, July, August, September. So it's really exciting, and it's just our competition continues to kind of grow in this way. I mean, our 2007 winner, we're helping her get her movie set up, and she's just became a finalist for the Tribeca Access Program, and she's, a really, really dynamic writer and director, and she just, her first short she made got into Slam Dance, and so she's, so we're really excited to be working with her, and we just, we're excited this year. We want to get a lot of people to enter, and we're really excited to continue to discover writers and directors and support them and keep expanding our mission, which is to, you know, find people like this. And it's pretty pretty fun that through the workshops we kind of discovered, you know, rediscovered Melissa Brandt, and you know, and now it's, you know, it just continues with our winners, and you know, so we're really excited this year to get some new scripts.
Awesome. Hey, I'm going to turn the interview over to my co-host, Devin. I have to run. He's going to have his first film produced this summer, and then he's going to continue with a few more questions. We won't take up too much of your time, but I have to run. I want to thank you for your interview. And, Devin, go ahead and take it away.
Hey, Gordy, how you doing?
Thanks.
Bye, Gordon. Gordy, thank you very much.
Hi. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You actually have a little bit of background with stage plays as well. You wrote a play called Tricycles back in 1999.
Yeah.
And now you're obviously also a screenwriter and who's also jumped into the director's seat. How is, with all these different forms, you got screenwriting, stage plays, do you find that you're, now that you're in the director's seat, do you find yourself directing from with that stage play background in mind, or do a lot of directing based more on the visual aspects of the script?
Well, I think it's very important. I think that what's lost is, you know, I saw two films the other day and back to back, and it seemed like the first one, the director was very concerned with, you know, the visual, using the use of the camera and composition, and the story and character elements were not, you know, developed well and structured well. And then in the second film, there was less emphasis on the stylistic use of the camera, and it was more about just telling a story and the interesting things that happen to people. And I think that somewhere in the middle, you know, you have to use the medium of cinema and, you know, and exploit that, exploit the use of, you know, and you being able to use a camera and where to place a camera and being able to move through time and space in a way that is difficult to do in theater fluidly. But you can't get caught up in, you know, in too much of the style and lose kind of the central basic fundamental things that occur in a stage play, you know, which include, you know, the emotional journeys of characters and what happens to them wire to wire in your narrative. So you've got to kind of, so my background in writing plays and directing plays, you know, definitely led me into a place where, and I find, you know, the things that I talk about when I'm conceiving what I'm going to be doing with the screenplay, with in the director's chair, as you put it, you know, I'm talking about much of the same things that I would be talking about if I was staging it in front of a live audience.
Now, working with past movies like with A Coat of Snow, you were the writer, the producer, and the director. And coming from my own background, I was producer and writer on my last movie, and I can see that, you know, there's a lot of different hats you have to wear when you're doing this, especially on an independent film. Do you find the independent, working with lesser-known actors who are just generally very excited, is it easier, and is it more of a challenge in some aspects, but do you find it to be more of a fun experience, more of an enriching experience to go through independent versus big studio production?
Well, I've never directed a big studio production, so I wouldn't be able to compare. You know, what's the only experiences I've had with directing has been three shorts and a feature, and they've all been, you know, pretty independently spirited movies, lower budgets, and that kind of guerrilla-type spirit. And so it's the only thing I really know. I can't really compare, you know, but I... So it's difficult to answer that, but I think that the experiences that I've had, you know, now that I'm starting to have, you know, kind of ramp up something that's going to be a significantly bigger budget than my last movie, I think, you know, again, we're talking about a lot of the same things. And so, you know, what you're doing right on a little $1,000 budgeted short that you might be shooting with your handheld HD consumer camera is going to be probably a lot of the same principles that you're going to have to remember, you know, as your budgets go up. Obviously, you know, things change to a certain degree, but I think the things that, you know, the attitudes that you bring to the job and to your execution are going to have to be, you know, they're going to be make or break if the budget's, you know, 1,000 or if it's, you know, 10 million or whatever.
So are you, do you find, though, with yours, since you're also the writer as well, going into something like this with an independent spirit in mind, you're not worried about, is the story going to get changed radically by the director, or is it going to get just totally rewritten, or you're going to get... You know,
well, I mean, I didn't direct Love Liza, so I've had, I had that experience. And, you know, I mean, for the most part, it was the script was honored. There were some things that were, you know, the director took liberties with that, you know, I'm not really completely sure that I would agree with, because that's probably a diplomatic way of putting it. But I think that's going to happen, you know. And, you know, for the most part, I'm proud of Love Liza. Well, I am proud of Love Liza, but yeah, I did not direct Love Liza, and I did lose control of some of the story that I put down on that script. So I had that experience, and then with Code of Snow, I wrote and directed it, so I had control over that. And with this project I'm doing, I'm not the writer, I'm directing it, but I do have that perspective that I can bring of both experiences on these two features that I've written, and know what kind of, know not to run over the writer or think that later on I'm going to switcheroo something on her, because I know how that felt, and I know how successful it was. It wasn't very successful at all, I don't think, and we need to trust the writer. I mean, that's what I can kind of bring to this current project, is that I'm a writer myself, and so I kind of respect, you know, I think it's, filmmaking is a collaborative medium, and when we're able to kind of, you know, be humble enough to acknowledge that we can't do everybody's job, and that everybody has a job, and allow them to do it, including the writer, that's going to probably conspire to make the best movie possible.
Well, as a question we've asked in the past of a couple of our other guests is that those who have worn multiple hats throughout the process, we usually ask them, going through the process as a writer and just as a writer is one thing. Do you feel that it's helped your craft as a writer, seeing and participating in the other aspects of filmmaking throughout, I mean, even your own stuff, your own material that you've helped bring to the screen from one form, in one form or another, has it helped you become a better screenwriter?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm writing something that I want to direct right now. I mean, I'm continuing to write, and the whole process of making the film, making Code of Snow, watching the difficulties in making any of the films that I've have been able to participate in, it informs the writing, you know, and also as a writer, I'm able to go to the writer of the project I'm working on now and talk to her about, you know, options that she might be able to explore, because something that she's devised might be a difficult production challenge. And so, yeah, there's some wonderful perspectives and that are created. And it's really healthy to have the experiences as a producer to look at how you're going to construct the screenplay and know, like, okay, what's going to be a problem here and what's not. And when I was writing Code of Snow, I was always thinking about, well, how difficult is this going to be to shoot? How much is this going to cost? I think, you know, writers have to eventually look at that. Sometimes, I mean, you know, I encourage writers to ignore all that, and oftentimes that's the best way to go about it, to get the best story on paper. But yeah, so, you know, I think it's definitely helped definitely helped me, I think, involve, you know, be able to understand the job of any of the three that were kind of talking about, the writer, the director, or the producer. And I think all of them kind of go hand in hand and kind of, you know, helping me understand. And even when I was acting for, you know, when I was young and then into my 20s and early 30s, I you know, it even, you know, that helped me considerably. So now when I talk to actors and know kind of their sensibilities and stuff, so that comes into play with the writing as well. So it's all hand in hand, and it helps greatly.
Okay, one more question, and then we'll let you go. And I know you got a really busy schedule, so I know it's kind of late there in the UK right now. It's about 10:30. So last question is, Love, Liza featured your younger brother in it as well. I have had some of the, I guess you say, strange privilege of working on a set with two brothers who are actors playing parts in a movie that I wrote. So it seems a little surreal seeing them play brothers and actually, you know, they are brothers in real life. And how was that working with your brother, seeing him basically speak the words that you wrote?
Well, it was great. I mean, I think it was something that we both looked back on and we navigated pretty well. And, you know, he did a great job, and I think he was very satisfied with the movie, and it's something that I'm glad we did. I think we're going to work again someday. I think right now it's important for me to kind of establish, you know, my voice without people feeling like it's always kind of intermeshed with Phil's. But we look forward to working together and me directing him and writing things for him and working with him. And I think we're excited to do that again. We just right now it's, you know, I got to probably put a couple more under my belt without him kind of around, so people can kind of ascertain what my voice is and what I have to say, and then we can get together and collaborate again, because I think it was really, people really like Love, Liza. A lot of people really love that movie, and so we're happy that, you know, it has this following, and that we were both able to kind of make that thing together and still have a great relationship today. So
thank you very much, Gordy. I'll let you get back to, well, probably sleep. Hope to talk to you in the future, and good luck with your projects, and we hope to see something great come out of this from Blue Cat.
Absolutely. We will look forward to hopefully getting some entries, and make sure that everybody knows that our competition deadline is coming up March 2nd. And we have a final deadline of April 1st, and our website is bluecatscreenplay.com. It's the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition, and really we encourage everybody to check out our website and see what we have to offer. We're one of the screenplay competitions that have been around since 1998, one of the longest running, and we do a lot of really good work, so we really love to encourage everybody to enter. Everybody who does enter Blue Cat receives a written analysis on their screenplay. So that's something that we, probably the first competition to do that, and we're still one of the only competitions that offer that. And so anyway, so we look forward to hopefully people checking out our website and entering their script, because we're looking for great writers and great script.
All right.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Take it easy. We'll talk to you later.
All right, you've been listening to Screen Talk Radio. I think tonight we've had a couple of really outstanding interviews with, of course, we just listened to Gordy Hoffman and earlier Paul Haggis. The theme, I think, tonight with both those interviews were, Devin, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but write what you know, write with passion, ask the tough questions, take chances as a writer, and also on the independent part, you can, as an independent writer, you can break into Hollywood. Any final comments, Devin?
I certainly do agree with all of that, what you had said and what Paul Haggis had said and what Gordy had said. We're all saying the same thing, really. Just stay persistent, never give up, have a lot of passion for what it is you want to do when you're writing. Write something you're interested in, and it will show through. Because if you write something go ahead.
Well, I'll just say I second that, and I think writers write with passion. Well, hey, that's our time for tonight. Writers, keep writing. Write what you know. Write with passion. Good night, and join us next week where we have another special guest, and we talk screenwriting.
Shout out to every young brother, you know, just doing his bid right now. Keep your head up. Just walking that yard, wish he had wings to just, you know, fly out of that joint. Yeah.